Parashishtante vasidrishikanairavritam brahmanishtai Acharyendram kadakalita chinmudramanandamurtim Swatmaramam muditavadanam dakshinamurtimide.
We're still on verse, and let's stay at another class on verse 9. And then we'll go to verse 10 next time. So for this one, repeat after me if you can.
Buddham bam sianalo nilambaram. Buddham bam sianalo nilambaram. Aharanato himam shiv puman. Aharanato himam shiv puman. Itya bhati chara charatmakamidam. Yajya bhati chara chara chakamidam yasyaiva murtyashtakam yasyaiva murtyashtakam nanyat kinchana vidyate vimrshatam nanyat kinchana vidyate vimrshatam yasmat parasmat vipoho yasmat parasmat vipoho Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Nama Idam. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Nama Idam. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Shri Dakshina Murtaye.
We just translate this again and then we'll go through it. Those of you who weren't here last week, I'll just do the sendi also, okay? Buhu, Ambamsi, Analaha, Anilaha, Ambaram, Aharanathaha, Imam Shihu, Puman, Iti Abhati, Characharatmakam, Idam, Yasya Eva, Mutyashtakam, Murti, Ashtakam, Mutyashtakam, Na anyat kinchana vidyate vimrshatam yasmat parasmat viboho tasmai shri guru murtiye namaha idam shri dakshina murtiye.
So namaha idam, this salutation, my salutation, but it's idam namaha, this salutation. They didn't usually say it like that. They just usually just say namaha. Namaha, but namaha idam, this salutation to Sri Dakshinamurti, to really Lord Shiva, to Ishwara the Lord, in the form of Dakshinamurti. Dakshinamurti as the first teacher, you know, who is also Sri Guru Murtiye, who is also in the form of my teacher. So Dakshinamurti is like the archetype, in a way. It's the Dakshinamurti of Shiva is the first teacher, that sampradaya from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, comes down even today to this, to my teacher, which means that the teaching of Dakshinamurti, the teaching of the Upanishad, which took place with Dakshinamurti as the first teacher, is the teaching of the Upanishad that should be taking place today if the teacher is a traditional teacher. That's what we mean by sampradaya. You know, it's like one candle lighting the next, lighting the next, lighting to the next, so that the flame is exactly the same. So the self that is being, the knowledge of the self that's being given is the same self, whether it's being taught, you know, millions of years ago or whenever, or now, the self is the same self. And so the Upanishad has to hold up a mirror to that, to your own nature. And so salutations to Sri Dakshinamurti as Shiva, Lord Shiva, as Ishwara, as the first teacher, who is now in the form of my teacher. So salutations to him. Then it says, whose form, yasya eva murti ashtakam, whose eightfold form, composed of charat, chara, achara atmakam, this eightfold, whose eightfold form, which is this, all of these moving and immovable things that exist in the creation, all of the things that move and all of the things that are stationary, this eightfold form. What are the eight things? First, all of the five elements, then the sun and the moon and the jiva and the living creatures. So buhu means earth. Five elements, so earth. Ambamsi, water. Anala, fire. Anila, air. Ambaram, space. Aharnathaha, the Lord of the day, the sun. Imam Shahu, that one who has cool rays, the moon. And Puman, the person in the form of the jiva, also the person in the form of Ishwara, the one who lights the whole thing up. So it's a salutations to the Lord Dakshinamurti, whose form is this, the divided up into eightfold, but what is the eightfold? It's just a way of dividing up the entire creation. So whose form is this entire creation, both subtle and physical? So salutations to Dakshinamurti, whose form is this entire universe, both subtle and gross. Who shines, Abhati means, who shines thusly as this eightfold form. And then he says, and beyond whom, Vimrishatam, for those who inquire, Vimrishatam means those who are doing the vichara, for those mumukshus, for those who are desirous of liberation, who are doing the vichara. So for those who are doing this analysis, who are exposing themselves to this teaching, for those people, they understand that there is nothing beyond. There is no thing beyond whom. So from beyond whom, and whom is what? Padasmat. Padasmat means the one who is the cause of everything, and who is viboho, pervasive to everything. Padasmat. Let's just tell what they say. Padasmat. Yeah, Padasmat, Sarva Karanat, the one, Karana means cause, Sarva Karanat, the one who is the cause of everything, and for the Viboho, the one who is the Adhishtana of everything, pervades everything. Adhishtana means the one because of whom everything else is. That's the Adhishtana. If we look at the satyam mitya, satyam is what is actually there. Mitya is what the mitya depends on the satyam, right? So that satyam, what is absolutely real, is the thing that is actually there. Whatever is mitya is totally dependent on the satyam, on what is actually there. And because it's dependent on that, that is called an adhishtana. Like a substratum. Substratum is sometimes translated as substratum, but it actually means the thing because of which this can be. So, for instance, to give you an example, if we use the rope snake analogy, the rope is the adhishtana. It's the thing which the snake, projected on the rope, the snake totally depends upon for its being. If you were to remove the adhishtana, the mitya has no basis. So the satyam or the rope is the basis. Sometimes we translate adhishtana as basis. So the adhishtana is the basis for the mitya, the thing that totally depends upon it. So we can even look at the clay pot, where the pot, the clay is the basis that the pot depends on. If I were to pull the clay away, there would be no pot. Rope snake is good for this also. If I would get rid of the adhishtana, the basis, then the mitya snake, which is totally dependent on it for its being, can't be. So without the adhishtana, the other can't be. So here, viboho means, one of its meanings is that which pervades everything as the adhishtana. So now, if we think of rope snake, if I pull the rope away, the snake is gone. There is no snake without the rope. If we look at this entire creation as requiring an adhishtana, then if I were to take the adhishtana away,
there would, if I were to take the basis away, there would be no creation at all. And so here, the absolute reality, which is the conscious, which is the consciousness, which is yourself, if I were to remove that, then the entire creation itself would have no basis, and so would have no way to exist. And so now, just I'm going to have to unfold this. Let me just babble about it for a while until we get into gear here. Okay, let me start this way. When we say Advaita, non-dual, one without a second, that means everything that you see here is only one. One without a second. What non-dual means that there is no second thing. If there's no second thing, everything that you're perceiving has for its being only that one. And yet everything we're perceiving is not one, it's many. So say if you say, we've heard, you know, little sayings like the one and the many. You say the one and the many. What does that mean, really? It sounds right. I mean, everybody has a sense that, you know, maybe you can think that in this whole manifest creation, everything is interconnected. And so because everything is interconnected, that makes it one. There's an interconnecting thread that goes through everything. And so we can say things like this is one universe. This universe that is made of an infinite variety of things on every level, infinitely divisible, infinitely interconnected, is only one because of the infinite interconnectedness of it. So that's what some people think when we say non-dual. You know, it's only one because everything is interconnected. So it's like saying there is infinite duality. In reality, there is an infinite duality. But we say that it is only one because it's all interconnected. Maybe you've heard this before. So that's one thing people mean when they say non-dual. Non-dual is a buzzword. It's a buzzword now, so it has many, many different meanings. But in Advaita Vedanta, that's not what it means. We accept the interconnectedness of the whole Maya, that everything in the creation is interconnected by an infinite series of laws. Laws that there's nothing that isn't connected, in fact. Everything is interconnected through an infinite network of laws. But within this infinite network of laws, there is duality. I mean, this table is different than this chair, right? On the level of the table and chair, the table is different from the chair. The right side is different from the left side. Top is different than bottom. You have a top and you have a bottom. Right? And so we accept completely the dual nature of the world, of everything that we experience. We accept subject-object relationship. I'm the subject, you're the object. You're the subject, I'm the object. Right? All of these things are in our experience. There's no use in denying them. It's not something to deny. Mm-hmm. And it's something that science and supports and all of our experience supports. But now, what is the level of reality of this duality that we accept? Is the level of reality of the duality that we accept, that we experience, an absolute reality, or is it a mithya reality? Why these terms become very, very important, if the whole Vedanta rests on these terms and on this understanding. If you were to say that this universe that we experience, that would include my body, mind, my sense organs, my perceptions, my thoughts, my moods, my emotions, you know, north, south, east, west, all of the quarters, the sun, the moon, the earth rotating around the sun, all of these things, all of this duality, if we were to accept that as satyam, as something absolutely real, it would have to abide by our definition of satyam. What is the definition of satyam? That's another thing. You know, you have to, if the Vedanta has a vision to give, you have to accept the way that it's using the words. So say if we say something is paramarthika satyam, it is absolutely real. Does this universe fit that category of being paramarthika satyam, absolutely real? Your next question should be, what do you mean by absolutely real? What does that mean to you? And so, according to the Vedantic definition of something that is absolutely real, it's that whatever it is something which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. It is, and it's never at any time subject to negation. What that means is that something which is absolutely real is not subject to change, because it's not subject to negation in past, present, or future. So then you say, well, why is that your definition of reality? Why do you say that what is absolutely real is not subject to change? You know? And the answer to that is this, that if something changes from one thing to another thing, then the prior condition, so here we have something here, and it's changed from a prior condition. This thing that is here now was not here before. Right? It's been born. It was not here before. And when it changes, it will not be here later. See what I mean? Anything that changes, at the moment that it changes, the prior condition no longer exists. And when that thing continues to change again, that condition doesn't exist either. And so now what this means is that anything which is that you experience, if it changes by its nature, it's bordered by non-existence, because it wasn't here before. Right? That's very simple. Something changes means what is here now wasn't here before. That's the condition of the universe. Everything in the universe is changing means the new condition is a new condition. It wasn't here before. It's modified. It's modified from something else. That something else is gone. This new thing is there. This modifies, and this that was here is no longer here. The new thing is there. That's the nature of the creation. We say that cannot be real. Anything that is subject to change cannot be real, because every moment of change is bordered by non-existence, and nothing can come from non-existence because non-existence is not there. We're not talking about shunya or emptiness or anything here. We're talking about non-existence. Nothing can come from non-existence because non-existence, true to the word, is not there for something to come from. So therefore, if something actually is, if it has actual being, it can't have a beginning, because that means it has a prior condition of not existing. See what I mean? And so, now, actually, if I use my, you know, clay pot example, we don't have a problem with this, because our mind always naturally fills in the gap. Like, for instance, if I have a lump of clay and I make it into a pot and I make it into a plate, I squash the pot and make it into a plate, even though these forms are totally negating one another, right? When the lump form is there, the pot form is not there. When the plate form is there, the pot form isn't there. The forms are totally negating together each other. But what actually is, isn't changed at all. And so we don't have a problem with these names and forms continually negating each other, because the satyam, the truth of it, isn't changing at all. The being of it doesn't change at all. So that's why we don't have a problem. Because we experience this world continually changing, continually changing, continually negating itself, moment to moment to moment to moment. But the negation is taking place, is dependent on something which is actually satyam, not changing. Right? The changing is dependent upon what doesn't change. And what doesn't change is never away from what does change. That's the satyam-mithya relationship. So we say satyam, for something to actually exist, to actually be, can't be subject to change, because it would be coming from non-existence. That's not possible. And all of this creation that we experience, because it does change,
it can't actually be. Because every moment is the negation of the prior moment. Every moment of change is the negation of the prior moment. And so this creation can't have any being of its own. So we call it mithya. Mithya means that which can't be categorized as satyam, nor can we say it doesn't exist. And so now what you're left with, you have to kind of sit and meditate upon this logic, but if you're following at all, what you end up with is if there is anything real that we call satyam, it can't be subject to change. And this whole creation, which is totally subject to change, can't have any being of its own, right? Because it's continually bordered every infinitely divisible moment by non-existence. So you have what is and what depends upon what is for its being. That's what you have. That is non-dual. To have duality, you have to have something which is and something else which is. And we have duality, right? But say if I have a table and a chair and a book and a person, and all of them are mithya. None of them enjoy satyam because none of them are satyam from their own standpoint. Because these are objects in the creation that are subject to infinite change. And if they're subject to infinite change, they have no being of their own. And so in order for them to be, they have to depend upon something which actually is. So this has no being of its own because it's subject to change. This has no being of its own because it's subject to change. This has no being of its own because it's subject to change. And so all of these things, and I could go divide these up infinitely also into smaller and smaller parts. It's the same problem. Each one of these things is infinitely subject to change on every level. If I were to dissect it, on every level it's subject to coming and going, subject to change. But on every single level, it is. This body is, this chair is, the table is, the rug is, you are. And even if we were to moment to moment to moment, moment to moment, as things are born and die, as things go on changing and changing and changing, what remains stable is it is. It is isn't changing. The nama-rupa, the names and forms are changing. The isness is not changing. Now, it gives us a kind of a... So the isness, the being that everything enjoys, remains a constant. And everything that changes enjoys that isness. So we have two things in our experience. Continually, we have two things in our experience that there's no change to this. This is a kind of a constant. In our experience, we have that which is, means that which never changes. It is always the same. And we have everything else. There's one thing that doesn't change, and everything else that does change. Now, why do I say there's only one thing that doesn't change? Why couldn't there be a whole bunch of things that don't change? Because anything that exists within this creation that we perceive has to change because it's part of duality. There's nothing within the time-space duality that isn't subject to change on every level. This is one huge motion machine. Whether it be on a subtle level, on the level of your mind and your moods and your emotions and even the I thought, or on the level of your physical body or the level of everything you perceive, it is subject to continual change. Now the question is there anything which is not subject to change? If there is, that which is not subject to change can't be an object in the creation. Because if it's an object in the
the creation, it's part of the motion machine. If it's part of the creation, if it's part of duality, it's subject to change. So that, look at your situation here. This world that you perceive is subject to change. Your physical body, definitely. Birth and death, subject to change. Subject to growth from childhood to, from babyhood to old age. All of your sense organs, subject to change. Your mind, your moods, your emotions, subject to change. Even your I thought, what you identify with, is subject to change. Even saying, I am, I am, I am, subject to change. All perceptions, all moods, all feelings, all relationships, all everything. All subject to change. So everything about you is subject to change. Except for you. Everything about you is subject to change. Except for what? I would say, except for the being that you are. The conscious being that you are. Why do I say that? Because, first of all, it's kind of the bottom line that you are a conscious being. But there's something else. Consciousness, we'll say consciousness itself, is consciousness an object in the creation? Can you look at it? Can I hold it up, some consciousness up to you, and say, this is the consciousness that you are. This is the consciousness. This is you, the conscious being. Can you do that? You probably have to say no. I know I am a conscious being, but I can't hold it out as an object. Can you say, do you exist? Are you an existent being? Yes, I'm an existent being. Can you see the existence? I can say, look at my situation, I can say about this whole creation, it is, 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 it is. I can also say the whole thing, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. But the being which I am, the conscious being that I am, it's not an object that I, it's not something I can objectify and have a subject-object relationship with. Like I can with all of you and with my body and my mind and my sense organs. I'm aware of it as a changing entity. And I illumine that the continual change that the body, mind, sense organs go through. But what about me, the conscious being that is there, lighting up without fail whatever is taking place? Is that one changing? It's such an interesting thing. We don't really... This is what we call this Vimrishatam. This is the one who, for those who, what's in the verse here, for those who are analyzing this situation, this is the analysis that has to be done. See, that your physical body is changing and growing old and whatever its aches and pains are, you're very much aware of it. The thoughts that you're having, very much aware of. I'm happy, sad, whatever the emotions are. Now look at the difference between you, the ones that light up, for instance, the emotions or the thoughts, and the thoughts themselves. An emotion, or if let's just take any thought, a thought comes, it is lit up, and it goes. You remain. This is true for every experience you have. You are the one who remains. All of the experiences come and go. Experiences, sense perception, the sense perception of the physical body, the perception of your mind, all of them come and go. Yeah? You don't come and go. All of them enjoy your being when they're there. You are the satyam. You give the conscious being to all of your perceptions. The conscious being never comes and goes. The perceptions of all variety are totally dependent upon you for their being, and they have been as long as they're there. When they move through, being remains, which is you, and they're gone. They don't take you with them. Just think about it. You have a thought. The thought is there. It has been. It is known, and it is. The thought goes. You're still there, but the thought is gone. It doesn't take your being with it. See what I mean? Your being is stable. Your being is the satyam. all of these things, all experience that you ever have, is mitya, because the being is what stays, the being is what doesn't come and go, and everything that you perceive does come and go. That's satyam mitya. If it comes and goes, it doesn't have any reality. What has reality, which is the being itself, that doesn't have a prior non-existence. Nothing can come from non-existence. So this type of viveka has to be there. If this viveka, if this type of discrimination is there, what does it mean in the end? What can't be the me, which I'm saying the being, or what's my experience of being is me, my amness. When I say I am, that's the being that we're talking about. This being that I am, which can't be objectified, what is its relationship to my body or my mind? You know this word, asanga? Asanga means it's not attached. There's a huge difference between me and what can be objectified and what changes. If the me, if the self that I am, is not subject to change or objectification, it basically has no sangha, no attachment at all with this physical body or with this universe. Nor is this universe away from it, because this universe has no being of its own. And so the universe is mitya. It's not just that my body is mitya. The whole universe is mitya. And the whole universe enjoys me. Why? Because I'm not something that comes and goes and can be objectified as an object within the universe. So let's just stick with me here for a while if you can. If my being isn't subject to being objectified, existing as an object within time and space, yeah, then let's look at this one. If I can't be objectified like that, then what size am I? If I'm not objectifiable, this conscious being that I am, I'm not one of the objects in space, what size am I? I have nothing to do with size. I have nothing to do with size. Can I enter, you know, be non-objectifiable? Can I enter, like peas in a pod, all of the objects in the creation? Am I like a pea in a pod, you know? The conscious being that you are, is it a pea in the pod? Like, am I a little conscious being filling this body, and you're a conscious being filling this body, and you're a conscious being filling this body? Say no. You can't be, because you're not objectifiable. Right? And so if that's so, if I'm not objectifiable, and everything, in fact, enjoys me for its being, in reference to this creation, this mitya creation, you know, what is it? What is this mitya creation in reference to me? But you can say, if, what if I ask like this? What is this body in reference to me? Just take your body. What is this body in reference to me? This body, mind, sense organs, totally enjoys me for its being, for its consciousness. That's true. That's such a mitya. This body, mind, sense organs enjoys the conscious being, which is satyam, which is real. The satyam doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, it doesn't change. I simply am. And the amness and being and consciousness that this body, mind, sense organs enjoys is me. It doesn't have any of its own, because it's coming and going from non-existence. It doesn't have any being of its own, so it totally enjoys me for its being. But the question is, does me, the me who's not objectifiable, is it like a pea in a pod stuck in it? Am I stuck in this body? Am I stuck in this mind? No, because I'm not objectifiable. You know, like say if I have a pitcher and I fill the pitcher with water, then the water's stuck in the pitcher, right? But water is objectifiable and the pitcher is objectifiable. We have two things within duality and one can be contained by the other. But I'm not objectifiable. And so this body, mind, sense organs totally depends upon the being, which is me, the consciousness, which is me, but I don't depend upon it. Because I'm not an object in the creation. I can't be an object in the creation. Now, you're all in the same situation. Yourself cannot, your body, mind, sense organs totally depend upon you 100% for their being, you know, and for the consciousness which they enjoy, but you don't depend upon it because you're not an objectifiable to be an object within the creation. Consciousness is not some sort of an object. If I'm not objectifiable as an object, I'm not stuck in any part of this creation. But the whole creation is mithya by nature. It has no being of its own. And yet I experience the whole thing as it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. There is nothing that I experience that is not. But the isness is only my amness. I don't look at some isness, I say, I am, and then it converts into it is. There's only one being, which is me. And that I'm the only one that has a direct experience of my own being because it's self-evident. It's not an objectifiable experience. It's true for all of us. When you say, I am, I exist, that's not something you can look at. That's something which is self-evident. That's what I mean by non-objectifiable. And that self-evident self that you are, is you can't do anything about it. You can't say, oh, I think I'll just blot that out for a while. Or try to change it, or try to manipulate it. It can't be manipulated because it's not objectifiable. And so what this boils down to is that we have one thing here, and then an infinite creation that enjoys it. I am the one thing. I, the conscious being, am the one thing, the satyam, the me, the non-objectifiable me. And the entire creation is mithya because the entire creation is infinitely divisible, is subject to change, and so is bordered every single moment by non-existence. I can even say, all right, in fact, moments are infinitely divisible. That's another problem, but let's just pretend like that's not true and take this as one moment. It's gone. It's already gone. As soon as I say it, even before I say it, it's gone. Right, the moment's gone. The future hasn't come yet. Moment's gone, future hasn't come. You've got this infinitely divisible moment in between. Totally, the bordering by non-existence goes into an infinite regress because as long as a moment is divisible, it has a past, present, and future. And a moment is divisible as long as it takes up time. If it doesn't take up time, you're in timeless. Then we don't have any moment. You're in timelessness. So any moment is infinitely divisible, and it means that you can't find the moment, and so you have a past which isn't there, and a future which isn't there, and a moment that you can't find. That's mithya. That's the nature of the creation. But it's no problem for us because the mithya of this creation has satyam. There is no mithya without satyam. Mithya has no existence at all. But it's here. That's why we say mithya is that which can't be defined as satyam or as asat, non-existence. So I am the existence which this entire creation enjoys. And so what is knowledge? This is Advaita, means I am the whole. In Advaita Vedanta, this is the vision. I am Ishvara. That is the vision. It's not that I am just pure consciousness. And then I don't know what the heck to do with this world. I am pure, changeless consciousness, and then there's this world that we just don't know what to do with. That's not Advaita Vedanta. Vedanta is, I am Ishvara. How are you Ishvara? You are Ishvara because there is one self that is the truth of mithya, of the whole manifest creation, which means this entire creation has a self. That's why we say the entire creation is Ishvara. Entire creation means what though? The creation is mithya.
What is the truth of the mithya is the sat-chit, conscious being. Who is the conscious being? I am the conscious being, not this body is mithya. Mind is mithya. The ahankara, the I notion is mithya. Right? The self is not mithya. It's the only thing that's not mithya. But that which is not mithya, that which is satyam, isn't an object. So what's to make me, the me that I am, this conscious being that I am, what's to make me different from you? You can't objectify consciousness. I can't objectify consciousness. Consciousness is not objectifiable. If it's not objectifiable, there's not a right side or a left side or a top or a bottom. You know, or consciousness that looks like this as opposed to a consciousness that looks like this. There's no duality from the standpoint of consciousness because it's not objectifiable. And so I am you. In fact, it's not that I'm like you. It's that there is only one me. Now, when I say, why do I say me? I say me because when you think of yourself, you think of yourself as I am. This is me. This is myself. This conscious being, this is who I am. And then, of course, you superimpose the mithya on it, the body, the mind, the sense organs. But actually, the body, the mind, sense organs, all these things that are superimposed upon me belong to, really, the whole mithya. This body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara, to the whole. Right? And the whole enjoys me. That is why we use the dream analogy, you know, or the dream analogy is so powerful. We have to use that dream analogy, or use, you know, like the imagination, like the meadow imagination. We need to use that so that you can understand the relationship. How is it that this entire infinite creation, which it can be myself, and yet I take myself to be an individual within it? How is that possible? Well, consciousness is not thinking. Right? Being isn't thinking. It's being is not saying, I am the one conscious being and you're all mithya. Consciousness isn't saying anything. Consciousness is non-dual. I am non-dual. My being is non-dual. So who's saying, who is the one who's saying, I am a person born at this and this time, you know, into this and that, such and such a place, and now 30, 40, 50, 60 years old. Who's the one saying that? It's not consciousness. The mind is saying, the body, the jiva is saying, you know, I am this body, mind, sense organs that was born at such and such a time. This is the great samsara, right? Because my mind has totally the true experience of myself as me, because there is no other self-experience other than me. But because of ignorance, it has the experience and at the same time takes myself to be it. You know? It's like this. If I imagine a meadow and I have a bunch of people in the meadow, and everybody in that meadow, you know, says, I am a conscious being, I'm a conscious being, I'm a conscious being. Oh, look at the meadow as inert, look at the sun up there, the clouds are coming. There are conscious beings in the meadow, and then there's also unconscious things like rocks and chairs and rugs and things like that. So that the being in the meadow is experiencing the meadow from its own standpoint as part of the mithya. But what's the truth, really? What's the truth? Say you have an imagination of a meadow with a bunch of people in it, including yourself. You take a form in it. What's the truth? The truth is I'm the self of the whole meadow. And the truth is the meadow is mithya. It has no reality. It has no independent reality apart from me. In fact, there's nothing here really but me. I am the satyam. I am the truth of the meadow. The meadow comes from me, is sustained by me. It goes back into me. I am its very being. And I say, I'm the Ishwara of the meadow. I'm the Lord of the meadow. Right? Because the whole meadow is known. The meadow is my body. It's like an infinite mind. The meadow mind. The entire meadow is known. It's one entity that totally enjoys me as long as it's there.
But whether the meadow is there or not there is absolutely really irrelevant to me, the one from whom the meadow comes. It makes no difference whether the meadow is there or not. The Satchit, the conscious being, is not affected by the presence or absence of the meadow. So now, what does it mean to have self-knowledge from within the meadow? The one Ishwara doesn't, the Ishwara of the meadow doesn't need self-knowledge, because Ishwara doesn't have any ignorance. From the standpoint of Ishwara, the Maya projects, is sustained, and it resolves, and when it projects, that whole swarupa, that whole nature, the manifestation of the creation is there and it is known. There's no ignorance at all. There's just the Maya Shakti, there's the projection. And the Satyam, and from Ishwara's standpoint, I am the Satyam, I am the being of this whole projection, of this whole infinite creation. I am itself. But the jivas, the individuals within the meadow, they don't know that, because their knowledge is limited by their limited body, limited sense organs, and limited mind. And so they say, each jiva in the meadow will say, I'm a limited being, I'm a conscious, existent being subject to birth and death. And so that each one of those, they all need, if they become a mamukshu and say, is that really true, or what is it? Is there something to know? Is that really the truth of me? They need a dream guru. They need a meadow guru, right? And what do they have to recognize? What they really have to recognize is that I am Ishwara. Why? Why do they have to recognize I am Ishwara and not just consciousness? Because if they don't recognize I am Ishwara, I am the whole, you don't realize that consciousness, the conscious being that you are, with this Maya, you know, projects the entire creation out of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. Your upadhi, body, mind, sense organs, is only a part of the whole. And what is the whole? Is an expression of infinite knowledge. That's what Maya is. It's an expression of infinite knowledge that enjoys one conscious self, which is you. And so this body then surrenders to Ishwara. What does it mean for this body, mind, sense organs to surrender to Ishwara? It recognizes that my being is the self of the whole, and that this infinite expression of infinite knowledge is something which contains, by its laws, every part of it. So this body, mind, sense organs is part of the greater story, which is Ishwara, and Ishwara is me. Otherwise, Ishwara is somebody else. Who would that be? You can't have two non-objectifiable selves. Because once a self, yourself, is non-objectifiable, it's not in time and space. It becomes the adhishrana, the thing which upon which the whole mitya, or upon which the whole creation, depends. So just think of it. If you imagine, a meadow with, you know, with all different animals in it and people in it and beautiful trees and sun and moon and stars, all of the, you know, that whole setting. Time and space exists within the setting. Right? The time-space exists within the setting. Dimension exists within the setting. But the whole setting exists within you. There's no part of it. Just like if you think with the rope snake analogy, there's no part of the snake that is away from the rope. Right? If the rope has three bends, the snake has three bends. If the rope is 2 inches in diameter, the snake is 2 inches in diameter. The snake can't flop over the rope, you know? The rope is the adhishtana, it's the very basis, the truth of the snake. And like that, I'm the very basis and the truth of this whole creation. Now, how do you experience that? What you have to see. This is your experience all of the time, in fact. Even though, from the standpoint of this body, you can't, from the standpoint of the body, you can't have the experience of Ishwara, the infinite creation. But from the standpoint of, even through your sense organs and this body existing within the time-space circumference of what you can experience, every single thing in your experience on every level is. But the isness that it enjoys
is not an object that you're seeing. Everything exists within the isness, which is your amness. There's no amness isness. You have to see that the amness, which is you, right, is not stuck with this body. It's not like it goes amness, boom, and nothing else is. That's not so. Everything is, right? And so you might as well say that everything am. The language confuses us, you know? The amness which you are, everything enjoys. The consciousness which you are, everything enjoys, either in terms of things that reflect the consciousness, like your sense organs and mind, or the things that are objectified. You either say, it is, I'm the knower or I'm the known, right? Known is consciousness. Known, 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 known. I can say my sense organs are both knower and known because I know my sense organs, they're known. And they're also responsible for perceptions. My mind, right, is a thinker, a feeler, all of these type of things, but it's also known. It's knower and known. It both reflects consciousness and it is illumined by consciousness. So all of your experience, really, if you forget the knower-known dichotomy there, and what you'll recognize is that, in fact, yes, some things function as a knower. Some things are only known because they don't reflect consciousness. But in fact, whether they're knower or known, all of them are known. Your mind is known, your sense organs is known, your body is known, the eye thought is known, all of your perceptions are known. There's nothing that's not known. What is the knownness? Like if I take this, like say, this book is known, now I get rid of it, put it behind my back. Now it's not, the book's not being known right now. But whatever is here is known. Right? Now my hand is known. If I take my hand away, that's not known. What's right in front of my eyes, that's known. Known never changes. Known is consciousness. Known is self-evident. You get rid of the whole creation, and what is there? Known. With no object. Known is synonymous with being with consciousness. It is never not there. Say you close all your sense organs, you meditate, and then you just watch the thoughts in your mind. They're known. You absorb the mind completely so the thoughts aren't even there. They're just totally resolving into the innermost subject. And what is that? What are you left with? Consciousness. Is that known? Yes. It is known because it's consciousness. Consciousness is known. And so because of this Dehatma Buddhi, you think that your consciousness somehow is like a pea in a pod. It's something that's contained in this body. It's not contained in anything. The whole universe is contained in it. And it's not even contained in the universe. The whole universe has it for its being. Like the snake has the rope for its being. And so people say, well, you know, why is Ishvara important? Which is what this verse is about. Why is Ishvara important? Because Ishvara is the truth. That's who you are. You're not just, when you say, you know, I understand myself as the Atma, but this is always asked to Swamiji. But Swamiji, do I really have to believe in God, you know? Ishvara? You know, is that really necessary? You know, because we have a phobia against all of these weird definitions of God. But in fact, what we mean by God or by Ishvara is the totality of what is. And the teaching is, I am that. I am that. It's not enough. It is not enough just to differentiate yourself as a conscious being. And get, like Krishnamurti, just get rid of all of the neti-neti, not this, not this, not this, not this, not this, not this. Because you're left with all this pile of not this. What do I do with it? And here's this body is not this too. Mind is not this. All of this is not this. So what is this not this? What is this not this? Do with that not this.
What?
Well, this body, which I'm negating, and I'm negating the world, right? So the consciousness is left out by itself. And then I have this body, which is not the consciousness, trying to relate with this world that is not the consciousness. It's kind of a mess. Well, how is it helpful?
I mean, to understand what it means to understand Ishwara is to understand I am the whole. And that's what works. That's the truth of it. You know? Otherwise, your self is limited and separate. If you say there's no satya mitya. There's one, you can say there's one limitless consciousness, and there's one limitless world. But you would have to prove that. And to prove it, you would have to be able to show whoever's teaching, one thing. Try to establish one thing in this creation. And you can't. Because everything in this creation is mithya. It's all bordered by non-existence. It's all infinitely divisible. You can't find a thing here. And the existence that you give to it is not an object. And so that's how the satya mithya, that's what we mean by satya mithya. It's something very concrete, actually, in terms of how we're using the term. And so here in this verse, what Shankara says is, my salutations to the Lord Dakshinamurti, who is the first teacher of this knowledge, the knowledge that's held in the Upanishads. And that teacher whose form, Dakshinamurti is there as a jiva, in the sense has a nama-rupa as an individual, as a conscious being, sitting there, you know, with his mudra, chin mudra, teaching these four vriddhas, these four elderly sages. And what is he teaching? You know, that I, the teacher, you know, am the one whose form is this entire creation. And then it says, the one whose form is this Ashtamurti, this Murti Ashtakam, this eightfold form that covers the entire time-space creation, everything that exists. So salutations to Lord Dakshinamurti, who is my teacher, because the self of Dakshinamurti is the self of my teacher and is the self of you. So salutations to Lord Dakshinamurti, who is my teacher, whose form is this entire creation of moving and immovable things, right? Which shines as the five elements and the sun and the moon and all of the jivas. Salutations to Dakshinamurti, who is my guru, who is also in the form of my guru, who is in the form of the whole creation, and beyond whom there is no other thing. Beyond whom there is no other thing. So this whole creation is my being, is my form, and beyond this there is no other thing. Who realizes that? The Vimarshatam. Those who have done this viveka. The viveka means that discrimination. The viveka, the vichara, is the whole teaching methodology. For those who have understood, this is what they see. And so this is a sweeping verse. It's the verse, the ninth verse, the tenth verse is the last one. It's a sweeping verse that gives the whole vision of what you're left with as the sisha, as the one who's being taught, is you have to see that in what the teacher, what Dakshinamurti is teaching is what your guru is teaching, and the self of Dakshinamurti is the self of your guru, is the self of you. And so Dakshinamurti is the one who says, this is my entire form. You have to be able to say, in the end, this is my entire form. This is my form, and beyond me there is nothing else. That's where you say, I am the whole. All of this, all the Mahavakya is, you know, Tatvamasi, you are that, you are Ishwara. If I say, I am Brahman, the conscious being that I am is the conscious being which is infinite. Advaita, non-dual. Satya Mitya, that's a non-dual, non-relationship. Mm-hmm. Right? What's the relationship between the clay and the pot? Is there a relationship? It's the relationship of satya and mitya. There is no pot apart from clay. What about the rope snake? Is there a relationship? It's the relationship of satya and mitya. Mitya has no being apart from the snake has no being apart from the rope. I have to see this is mitya. What does it mean? It doesn't, these words apparent in all of this or illusory that we have, it's not that they're misleading words. It means all of this reality, which has its own order and all of its laws, and it can be objectified, all of these things, is totally dependent upon Satchit, the being which is me, for its being. There's no second being there. So that's what we mean, that is what we mean by the mithya. And so you have to, in the end, say, I am Ishvara. Just like you can say, if you imagine a meadow, just like you can say, I am the meadow. If I can say, I am the meadow, then I recognize that the meadow exists in me, is supported by me, I am its truth. And yet, even though it totally depends upon me for its being, I don't depend upon it. If that reality is understood, you have to look inside of your own experience, even when you meditation or just moment by moment, day to day. You are not changing at all. Not at all. It makes no difference what your moods are, what your thoughts are, what your perceptions are. Those things are continually changing. Some are good, some are bad. There's all kinds of things going on. Nothing is happening to you. Zero. Nothing. Nor do any of these cover it in any way. That's what needs to be recognized. It's not having... You can gain a quiet mind, you can have a spiritual mind, you can have meditative experiences. Oh, these are all fine. But whether you have a messy mind or a spiritual mind or meditative mind, yourself is illumining all of them. It's not preferential. Yourself doesn't say, I think I'll illumine the meditative mind a little bit more than I'll illumine the painful mind. No, it does a great job. It totally illumines the painful mind. and it totally illumines the meditative mind too. You can say, yeah, but I like the meditative mind. I don't like the painful mind. That's your mind saying, I want this kind of mind and I don't want that kind of mind. Well, I agree with that. I'd rather have this kind of mind too than a painful mind. But that isn't a statement on your being, which is there absolutely present, changelessly present to the whole array of states of experience, or to the whole array of the entire creation, in fact. That is jnana. When we say, you are free, we're talking about yourself. Your mind is changing. It's free because it's mithya. It's free because no matter what it does, it can't hurt you. You know, that you are its very being. And it, the mithya mind, revels in that freedom. That the being that you are is by your very nature is whole and complete, and the mithya mind cannot do anything ever to change that. It can't make you better and it can't make you worse. And so it can just relax and be so happy that its self is a free self. You know, the mind's self is a free self. The mind has it is what it is. It's not that you gain knowledge and all of a sudden the mind stops thinking. You know, or you gain knowledge and all of a sudden the world becomes beautiful. The world becomes beautiful and horrible. It's everything. You know, but yourself doesn't become beautiful and horrible. You know, yourself isn't subject to those opposites. And so Ishvara is not subject to those opposites either. You know? It's like when you wake up from a bad dream, you recognize nothing's really happened. Well, that's Ishvara. Nothing has really happened. But the whole infinite creation expresses in this way. So, okay, that's good enough for now. We'll do the last verse the week after next. Right, so let's just take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamada
Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Mm-hmm. Are those rules considered satyam?
No, Ishwara. That's all within Maya. But all of that's the order, that's the empirical order of the creation.
Okay.
But the rules are part of duality, right?
Right.
Yeah. All of that is Ishwara. The order, you know, the infinite order of the creation is Ishwara.
I was wondering, like, partly what I find confusing is the modern thinking, like, these ideas like chaos theory, you know?
Well, they call it chaos theory, but they're discovering the order on a smaller level. Mm-hmm. It's an infinite order, but they're finding ways to, they're discovering these orders on different levels of micro levels. And
atomic levels.
Mm-hmm. When I say I am the whole,
mm-hmm.
What comes to mind first, that you have to give up the sense of the I am the body and I am this upadi?
It's not so much giving up the sense of it, because the body from its own standpoint enjoys being in consciousness. Mm-hmm. That's why I can say I'm a conscious being, you know. But you recognize that this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that the consciousness which you are is the consciousness which Ishwara is. So what that really means too for you is that your body, mind, sense organs have the one that's illumining it, you, the conscious being. That conscious being is Ishwara, is the self of Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so in that way, you are one. You're not in union with God or in union with Ishwara. You are Ishwara, because there's only that one self. And then this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara. Just like, sometimes we use the example of just like so many cells in the body. The cells in the body and the different organs in the body are part of the body. They belong to the body. The complex order that governs the body governs every part of the body.
Yeah.
You know? And so the complex order of the creation governs every part of the creation. And so in a way you relax into the creation, because the creation is not somebody else. You know, it's not that this creation is an infinite, beginningless, infinite expression of your timeless self. You know, it's not like there's some God here who's ruling a bunch of jivas down here. It's that the infinite manifestation of the creation comes from the self, just like a dream, for instance, comes from the self. This creation comes from the self, sustained by the self, goes back into the self, beginning from beginningless time. And so this creation is an expression of who? Of you. And your body, mind, sense organs belong to that infinite expression. And so when we say surrender, you know, we have these words like I have to surrender to God and these type of things, surrender to Ishwara. What does it mean? I mean, liberation really is that the body, mind, sense organs are given back to Ishwara, to whom it belongs, you know? And then the self that you are is the self of Ishwara.
So with the creation and without the creation, I'm still experiencing
yourself,
myself,
not as an object, because yourself is self-evident. It's not it's not objectifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what? So by self-evident, we use the example of like the sun. The sun is self-evident, self-shining, in the sense that you don't need to bring in another light to light it up. You know, so that the sun experiences its luminosity, do you have to bring in another sun? It is the luminosity. So consciousness, the consciousness that you are, is its own consciousness. You don't have to bring in another consciousness to illuminate, and a consciousness to illuminate. That's what we mean by self-evident. You don't need a consciousness behind it to make it conscious of itself. It is the consciousness. It's the bottom line, because of which everything else is illumined.
But you still have an experience of yourself. So now this is interesting, because now are you still having an experience of you being an object to that sakshi that is looking, that witness that is looking at yourself?
Only, well, you have to be careful there. We use this sakshi means witness, only to do the drikdrisha viveka, see or seeing differentiation. So actually the physical body is lit up by the sense organs. Without your sense organs, you wouldn't have knowledge of this body. It depends on the sense organs. Mm-hmm. See that? Yeah. You lose your eyes, you don't see the body, for instance. Use your hearing, you can't hear the body. Mm-hmm. The sense organs require the mind for them to do their job. If your sense organs are open, they're present, but you're daydreaming, then the sense organs aren't working. Somebody might see you with your eyes open, but you're not seeing anything because your mind's daydreaming. So the sense organs require the mind to use them. So they're actually just instruments. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so now, so far so good, we have sense organs needed to illumine the body and the mind needed to illumine the sense organs. But then the mind also is illumined. The mind also is known, all of the thoughts in the mind, for instance. Mm-hmm. So now, what is lighting up the mind? So from the standpoint of the mind, we call consciousness the sakshi. Mm-hmm. But from the standpoint of the witness, but from the standpoint of consciousness, it's not a sakshi. It's not witnessing anything, it's just consciousness. Mm-hmm. The mind has to be there for it to be witnessed. If the mind's not there, it's not like the sakshi is going, what happened to the mind? You know, it's not doing anything. It's just conscious being. Now, when you meditate, and I advise that meditation, just because you give yourself a chance to slow everything down, you just let your mind ask, is my being, the conscious being that I am, is it doing anything? Or is it just being what it is? Is it, why don't you ask it, can you just, you know, turn up the voltage a little bit more? Be a little bit more, turn up the consciousness factor a little bit more. Let yourself be a little bit more. No, it is what it is. All you would be doing is making your mind differentiate it a little bit more. The mind can do that. It can focus a little bit more. But the being that's lighting it up is just exactly what it is. It never changes in any way. It doesn't become bigger, it doesn't become smaller, it doesn't have anything to do with time or space or objectivity. So even right now, if you're just kind of aware of your being, you are not doing anything. You just simply are. And who you are is whole and complete. There's no feeling like, oh, I wish I could be a little bit more. Or a little bit less. That all belongs to duality, to the different conditions of the mind. I want my mind to be like this, and, you know, I wish I could be like that, I wish I looked like this and didn't look like that. It goes on and on and on. That's all problems in the mind.
So they're basically two simultaneous experiences. One is the consciousness recognizing that you are nothing but consciousness. And then the other one is recognizing that you also have a body with a mind and sense organs that are simply functioning, but that are also of that same nature, really, of that consciousness.
Yeah, the body, mind, sense organs totally depend upon consciousness for its being, for its sense of being, for its sense of meanness. That is the consciousness. But consciousness isn't doing anything to be aware of itself. It's aware of itself because it is consciousness. There's no duality there. It's not thinking, I'm aware of myself. It just is aware of itself because it's conscious. That's its nature, it's consciousness.
But the witness is still there. So the witness...
The witness is... That is a misnomer, really. That's the witness drops off when we realize that the mind is really simply being illumined and labeling the consciousness as a witness. But the word witness has a sense of doership in it, as though I am witnessing, right?
That's beautiful.
There's no one doing witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
It's only from the standpoint of the mind feeling, you know, I am known. The mind feels I am known. And so therefore there must be somebody knowing me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually there isn't somebody knowing me, it's that consciousness illumines and gives knownness to whatever is in front of it. Right? But it's not performing an act of witnessing, because then what happens is you give knowership in the form of the witness to the consciousness, and then I am knowing my mind. Whereas I'm not knowing anything. Knowing is my nature. I'm never not knowing. I'm never not consciousness. So I'm not doing a function. It's not a function. It's just me, my nature. Like, notice your own being right now. You're not doing anything. Just the me. Just your own presence. You're not doing anything. You never do anything. You're always exactly the same. And you can't do anything about that.
So Sakshi is not like something done by the mind.
No, Sakshi's not done by the mind. Sakshi, but the mind is illumined. And so when the mind is illumined, it is known. The mind wants to say, who knows me?
Mm-hmm.
I am being witnessed, therefore there's a Sakshi.
Mm-hmm.
And we use that to differentiate consciousness from the mind, which is known. But then you have to go farther than that to realize that, oh, the consciousness itself that illumines the mind doesn't have any tools to be performing any type of an act, to be knowing something. It just is luminosity itself, and the mind reflects consciousness, and so it, of course, is known. And then the mind uses the sense organs to illumine whatever the jiva's perceptions are. But consciousness is not doing anything.
And there's no witness, so it's a kind of an illusionary kind of thing then, that the mind, because consciousness is illuminating the mind, now the mind is kind of...
Then the mind takes itself to be the conscious being.
Yeah.
That's that sense of doer.
The mind takes itself to be the conscious being, the knower, the enjoyer. That's why, that's what we call this adhyasa, the superimposition.
Mm.
Like if the mind says, I am the conscious being, even though the mind itself is illumined, when it takes itself to be the conscious being, then it's superimposing itself on consciousness and consciousness on itself. Where, in fact, consciousness just illumines the mind. It can be differentiated from the mind. And so the jiva, the individual, the person in the middle of the meadow, has built into it by the mere fact that it's part of the scene, it's part of Ishvara, it's limited with sense organs and limited mind, that ajnanam is built into its situation. Because that limited mind, as long as the mind is there, it enjoys consciousness. Because it's sattva. It's made of sattva, rajas and tamas. It's made of sattva. That's the material it's made out of. You know, and so if it always enjoys consciousness, why shouldn't it say, I am the conscious being? And the teacher has to come along and say, well, you know, the problem is this, is that your thoughts go on changing, and consciousness stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The consciousness is not changing with you. And so you have to be able to differentiate the conscious being from the mind, you know, which enjoys it fully. But the difference is that the mind enjoys consciousness fully to say that I am a conscious being, but the conscious being never changes and the mind does. There's that anvaya vyatireka, you know, when the thought is, consciousness is. When the thought is gone, consciousness is gone. No. When the thought is, consciousness is. When the thought is gone, consciousness still is. What does that mean? Asanga. There's no relationship. There's no attachment between your conscious being and the experiences that you're having. So there's one non-objectifiable experience, which is you, that is there along with all of the mithya experiences. The mithya experiences in no way touch or change you. You have to notice this.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't some, this is not a philosophy, right? This is a description. There's a big difference between a philosophy and a description. You have to see what they're talking about, you know? And it happens to be very logical also. But Vedanta is not a like a philosophy, you know, like a catechism where, you know, this and this and this and this and this. It's pointing, it's descriptive, it's pointing to you, to something for you to recognize about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that something sets you free, because yourself is free. That's why it doesn't make you free. Does it change you into a free being? It makes you recognize the free self that you are.
It's really not that far from like the way Socrates is supposed to have taught, question and answer, and he talks about really what I'm doing is helping the student to recognize what they already.
In that way. But I don't know that he has the same. It's a little different.
Well, what
he's
teaching is different.
Because it's all teaching within the values and
stuff. Yeah, with the methodology is similar.
So but it's very clear.
See you there.
It's very clear you can only see what you can see. You know, that's just so.
Yeah.
That's so humbling about this teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, the finest nuances put your trajectory of your vision on a slight angle. It feels like the angle's constantly shifting through the teaching here, but it's kind of, in fact,
in the teaching methodology, it's kind of like Swamiji's talked about sometimes, as though the teacher has this flashlight that's pointing at the ahankara. Because the ahankara, the I notion, you know, the ego, is so used to taking itself to be the jiva, you know? And so the teaching comes at it from all different angles, you know, shining a light here and then it scoots over to this other little place where it can hide, and then it comes around and gets it there, and then it scoots over to another place where that ajnanam, that ignorance still is, you know, until it lights it up so much that it dissolves into reality.
What
I'm saying, though, is that the Upanishads do approach this knowledge from so many different standpoints, because we as individuals experience life from so many different standpoints.
What does a mind get out of this when it realizes that the self is?
It gets rid of it. It realizes that it was what it's always been seeking. It is. It realizes that what it's always sought is hidden in the seeker, is the very nature of the seeker, the ananda, the wholeness, the fullness, the feeling of oneness, the lack of isolation. You know what every human being seeks. It's really we're just running after ourself. And so the mind finally comes home to the home that was itself all along. But because of projection and because of adyasa, it runs after everything in the world that lights up. Well, if I had this, I would be whole and complete. If I had this, I would be full. You know?
So amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know, there was an analogy once that you sometimes tap into. I just wanted to get the details because I forgot and I wanted to think about it more. There is the horse coach, there are the reins.
Oh,
there's the one who sits in the driver's seat, and the horses are the mind, I think, or the sense organ.
That's in both the Katha and in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah. Could you just break that down for a moment?
The horses are the sense organs.
Mm-hmm.
The reins are the manas.
The
reins are the mind. The reins for the horse. The buddhi is the charioteer.
Uh-huh, right.
And the atma, the self, is the one sitting in the, you know, in the charioteer. The jiva.
Oh, okay.
That needs knowledge.
Okay.
Right?
Thank you.
And then the sense objects are what the horses are running wildly after. Yeah.
But the manas normally
is the reins that are being dragged.
But the manas is also the sense organs are part of the manas, right?
So no, the sense organs are, the five sense organs are held by the manas, which is held by the buddhi. But sometimes, Swamiji says, sometimes talks about the buddhi is kind of drunk. it's not able to hold, it doesn't have knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so the buddhi will be, you know, captured by the sense organs. The sense organs have, the horses have control of the reins of the manas, mm-hmm. not the buddhi. And so the buddhi is being dragged along by the sense organs. Because the reins, right, the reins are being dragged by the horses rather than the buddhi having control of the reins.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's the intellect more in terms of the manas now. What do you...
The manas is the mind.
Yeah.
And the emotions.
Yeah, so that's why I was confused when you call the horses... Oh, the emotions.
Organs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
The horses are the sense organs.
Okay.
The manas is just the fluctuating mind and
yeah.
all of the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And the buddhi is the one who has the knowledge.
Okay.
So the buddhi sometimes is overwhelmed, you know, by the sense organs, which are running wildly after
mm-hmm.
their objects of desire. It's like the, if you were a child, if you're a child on a horse, and the horse is hungry and starts riding, galloping toward the barn.
Yeah, that's right.
It wants its food, and that's the end of it. No brains, nothing. Buddhi just has to hang on for dear life.
Yeah, I can relate to that. It happened to me once when I was up in Tahoe. It's like I was about 7 years old, and then all of a sudden the horse started galloping, and I had, what the hell?
Can't do anything. You have to hang on for dear life.
Yeah. That's right.
You did well.